You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A brief program note to join Talk of the Nation hosts and guests on Monday in this hour for the latest on the war in Iraq. For the rest of the hour today, we're going to talk about forensic science, forensic identification. You've seen a lot of it on television about the crime scenes, but it's being used all over Iraq now. Remember earlier this week, U.S. forces dropped four so-called bunker buster bombs on a home in Baghdad, acting on intelligence reports that indicated that Saddam Hussein, his sons, and other top Iraqi officials may have been meeting inside. Following the strike, Brigadier General Vincent Brooks said at a briefing from CENTCOM headquarters in Qatar that it's possible that we may never be able to tell who is present without some detailed forensic work. Well, what kind of forensic work would be required to establish, without a doubt, the status of Saddam? And what about all the bodies that have turned up, those hundreds that were found in the makeshift coffins? How do you identify those? Well, joining me now to talk about the tools and techniques available for forensic identification work is Max Hauck. He's a forensic anthropologist, formerly with the FBI, and now projects director at the Forensic Science Initiative at West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Let's talk about those bombs in Saddam Hussein. Is there any possibility that, you know, that we could ever find out who was there? Was everything vaporized?
Well, it certainly would not be an ideal crime scene. Let's put it that way. Typically, in forensic science, I use the shorthand to describe what happens is CIC, collect, identify, and compare. The collection in that case would be at best difficult because of the nature of the bombs and who knows who was there and all of that. It would be very difficult to sort out. Explosions are difficult crime scenes anyway, and this one would be made doubly difficult or even more so simply because of the nature of what those devices are meant to do.
How much material do you need for, let's say, a DNA identification, if you could get any from that site?
Well, for DNA identification, you don't need very much at all. Mm-hmm. If you can see it, you can analyze it. And they may be reduced to swabbing chunks of concrete with cotton swabs to collect samples for analysis.
It's a lot of concrete to go through.
Well, back to my original statement, that's going to be a very difficult scene to process and to sort out and make heads or tails out of.
How soon do you have to get to that site?
If it dries, you're usually fine. It'll last for a number of days. The problem, though, is that it's not a sterile lab environment. And so bacteria and sunlight both degrade DNA, and that makes it difficult to use. So they probably have a matter of days, for at least for nuclear DNA. And there's another type of DNA that's used called mitochondrial DNA, and that is a much more rugged molecule. It's a much more rugged type of material, and that is that would last much longer. It can be gotten from bone, hair, and teeth, and so that might be a better bet for recovery, although it can't be used for positive identification.
1-800-989-8255 is our number. We're talking with Max Hauck, who's Projects Director and Forensic Science Initiative at West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia. How different is forensics at a site like that than you might have at a crime scene? Is it basically the same kind of science here?
It's exactly the same kind of science. It's just at it's a different scale. You would go through and find, you'd look for remains, and then you would go from the largest to the smallest, from the most general exam to the most specific exam. And, for example, you'd look and see if you had fingers for fingerprints, teeth or portions of jaws for dental identifications. But all of this is presupposing that you have known X-rays or known dental charts or known fingerprints of whoever you're trying to identify. And that's the comparison process.
If you were to use DNA, how close a family relative would you need to make a positive ID?
Well, you could do what's called reverse paternity testing, where you would get the mother and the father and work your way back to that individual's DNA. And I'm not sure, I'm not sure how or where the government would be obtaining their known reference samples, but those would be needed in order to do DNA analysis.
What about all these palaces that the Marines and the Army is going through? Could they not collect possible, you know, hairs on brushes, things like that?
They could, and in fact, things like even toothbrushes can be used. Those were used as known samples for some of the victims in 9/11, for example.
Mm-hmm.
But that you have to be able to have a pretty good confidence that there was only one person using that item, that toothbrush or that hairbrush or that clothing. You can even get it from sloughed skin cells out of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
So they may be able to do something with that as well.
We're not even sure of how many people were involved in the target of that attack. How do you tell, you know, the makeup of the people who might have been there?
Well, what you do is in forensic anthropology, there's something referred to as minimum number of individuals, or MNI. And what you do is you take all of the remains that you find and orient them in terms of where they came from in the body, and side them, if it's from a side, right or left, and that sort of thing. And then you figure out, at a minimum, how many individuals that represents. And you work back from there. In this case, there also may be personal effects, there may be travel logs, there may be other types of documentation that they could use to either include or exclude people from possibly being in the building.
Mm-hmm. Last week, British troops made a grisly find. I'm sure you saw those pictures of that building filled with boxed, I think it might have been even cardboard box remains of bones. It appeared to have been there for a while. What can you tell from remains that old?
Well, you can tell quite a bit. You could determine what's called a biological profile. So you could assess whether the person was male or female, how old they were, their ethnic background in some cases, how tall they were, if they'd had any surgeries or operations or diseases that would be represented by in the skeletal material. The identification of those individuals, since they're more or less complete, would be fairly easy. The problem, again, would be getting known samples to compare against, or x-rays or some sort of record to indicate that is that person.
Mm-hmm.
Personal effects may also be used in some instances if you have no other choice.
If the soldiers over there are finding bodies, is it easy to tell if someone has been shot in battle or has been executed? The difference?
The location of the wound and the type of weapon used might be an indication, but it may be difficult to tell, especially if all you have is a skeleton. If you have soft tissue, that can be much more telling, much more instructive. If there's a contact wound to the back of the skull, that's pretty good evidence of an execution-style shooting.
The president has said he's going to hold people committing war crimes responsible for their acts. That would mean you'd have to collect a trail of evidence if you're going to have a trial, correct?
Exactly.
How easy or hard is that to do in a battleground situation?
It becomes difficult, although once you have control of the scene, which is true of, and this is true of any crime scene, the first thing you do is control the scene, that is, limit access. After that, it becomes fairly easy to establish a chain of custody and collect evidence and register it onto a log and that sort of thing. And the military has excellent, excellent investigators. I've worked with investigators from all over the country, and the military investigators are some of the top people that I've ever worked with.
So they don't need to call in the FBI or other crime scene people?
Well, they may for some assistance, but typically the military, they have their own crime lab, they have their own investigators, they have their own morgue up in Dover, and so they're in terms of this sort of thing, they're pretty self-sufficient. They may call in other agencies to assist simply because of the size or the scale of the matter.
Talking with forensic expert Max Houck this hour on Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Let's see if we can take a phone call or two. Let's take this one to Ann in Hudson, Ohio. Hi, Ann.
Hi. I would also like to say there was a grisly find, Ira, before I go into my question, there was a grisly find at Battellin, Ohio, and Dugway Proving Grounds in the Smithsonian where weaponized anthrax is stored. But to comment on what you said. My question for Max is, I understand that animal protein takes about 4 hours to break down in the stomach. So how long do you think it would be for evidence of a crime of a human against an animal would disappear from a human's body?
I'm not...
I guess she's saying if you ate an animal, how long would it stay, evidence of eating a steak or something, stay in your stomach?
Well, it depends. I mean, for food to go through your body completely takes about 24 hours. But there would be remnants probably up to 8 or 9 hours after the fact in the stomach. There may be other contents in the intestines and that sort of thing. I'm not a pathologist, but it would stomach contents is typically what's done at autopsy if you're concerned about time of death or possible poisoning cases.
Well, we only have a minute or so left. What is the biggest challenge to forensics in that theater of warfare over there?
It's the same challenge that we always face. It's sorting out what's important and what's not, what is a clue and what's just background stuff that we have to possibly collect but not analyze. And it's the sorting that makes it difficult.
Mm-hmm. But also, I guess, establishing and maintaining that chain of evidence.
Absolutely crucial, especially since these may be prosecuted as war crimes. That's absolutely essential because this is the critical evidence to indicate war crime activities.
Are soldiers trained in this, just general combat soldiers, if they come across something that might be useful?
No more than the average person, and that's why there's so much training that goes into operating crime scenes, the processing them, because it does take somebody who's got a trained eye and experience and knows what to do and how to handle the evidence and to ensure that chain of custody. As we saw in the OJ case, that chain of custody is everything.
Mm-hmm. But if you're looking for evidence of war crimes, if you're looking for evidence of the death of Iraqi officers or members of the government, I would think that you'd be aware to watch out for these sorts of things, possible evidence.
They could be made aware of that, but in terms of actually collecting it and processing it, they might say, well, we have a room full of bodies over here and keep people out of that.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of the soldiers themselves actually processing the scene, they I doubt they would have any training at all.
Can you give me a ballpark estimate on how long it might take to make a positive ID of, let's say, Saddam Hussein or anybody else who might have been evidence that might be found in that hole in the ground?
Well, from the day of collection, I would imagine it shouldn't take more than a couple months, maybe, if that. It just depends on how many samples are submitted and what priority that would be given in the laboratory. And I'm sure the Armed Forces DNA Identification Laboratory would be doing the work.
Do you have any idea of the size of how many people are over there working on the forensics?
I have no idea. I know that the military's pulled in some of their people from the Office of the Medical Examiner. I would say there's probably maybe a couple dozen people.
Mm-hmm. Max Hack, we've run out of time. I want to thank you for joining us this hour.
Thank you.
Max,
appreciate it.
You're welcome. Max Hauck is a projects director at the Forensic Science Initiative at West Virginia University in Morgantown, West Virginia. That's about it for this week. Our program is produced by Annette Heist, Adrian McDonald, Clementine Wallace, and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our director. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Talk of the Nation Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 37th floor, New York, New York, 10020. You can also surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have archives of Science Friday, past programs that you can listen on real audio player, or you can download it and listen and stream on audible.com. Also, you can find back issues of Science Friday, and also you can find curricula we make out of Science Friday, all lessons and free curricula we make for yours to take from there. I'm Ira Flato in New York.